Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 60 of NML Crossing, where it's been a minute, hasn't it? Apologies for that, of course. The reasons for my absence are, I don't know. I guess I'll level with you. I kind of came up against it these past few weeks here. It's been not great. Very, like I hit a brick wall of extreme depression. It was not good. And you know, depression in and of itself sucks. I've got a lot of guilt that I deal with. Everything in my life I feel guilty about. And I mean, I won't bore you too long with this. I know this isn't what people hit play for, but it's been rough. And truth be told, I tried recording this episode almost every day since I put up the last one. And I'm tangent-laden at my very best, right? I jump into tangents all over the place. I can't stick onto one subject for too long. These past few weeks, in my attempts to do this, my tangents got kind of wild. It took me into some very strange places, just trying to, I don't know, kind of share what I'm going through with the same time not bore people. I must have tried recording this a dozen times already, and I've never once gotten to the actual comic book part. It was just me rambling and going down various holes and into the weeds, and it's just been, I don't know, an exercise in ridiculousness, basically. But I won't vamp much longer about everything that's going on here. It's just been not good, to the point where extreme things might have to happen. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes here. But for today, we are together. So how about we finally wrap up this damn Mosaic story, huh? And we're going to do so when we look at Detective Comics number 732, which had a May 1999 cover date. Mosaic Part 2, written by Greg Rucka, with art by Frank Terran. Colors, Gloria Vasquez and Wildstorm Studios. Letters, John Costanza. Edits, Vincenzo Illich and O'Neill. Cover price, $1.99. Now, let's see if we remember where we were, huh? We pick up moments before we left off last time, thankfully, where Barbara has her sights set on Roman Sionis. Is that how you say his name? Roman, the Black Mask. And she's mentally preparing herself to pull the trigger. Of course, she's safe, well, relatively safe, in the clock tower. And, the False Facers, or whatever his cult is called, they're trying to take that neighborhood. And so, she's got Roman in her sights when the all-new, all-different Batgirl swoops in to crack some skulls. Now, Babs, as you can imagine, is gobsmacked by the sight of her replacement. We spend several panels jumping back and forth between Batgirl beating the bejesus out of the Black Maskers and Barbara struggling to deal with this odd and very unexpected turn of events. From here, we jump over to the GCPD, where Montoya and Bullock have caught Commissioner Gordon and Sarah Essen in the midst of a very, very heated argument. And I mentioned Jim balling up his old man fist last time out. Here, Sarah is literally daring him to use it. Like, you know, like the, come on, big man, you want to do it? Do it. Renee tries to interject in order to inform the commish that his daughter's home is currently under siege by the False Face cult. We jump back to Batgirl, who has single-handedly taken out all the trash. She's even captured the main man behind the cult, Roman Sionis himself. As she's shouting threats, Barbara trains her crosshairs right on Batgirl's dome, before lowering the rifle and thinking a little bit more on this assumed Bat betrayal. Or maybe Bat-trail. Now at this point, the GCPD have arrived on the scene. They meet up with Officer Lowell, the one with the flare gun from last time. She reports that the Maskers never made it inside the clock tower. Bullock looks around and he He asks if this means that he is back. Lowell corrects him, saying that it was not a he, but a her. Jim rushes up to the clock tower and he busts in the door to ensure Barbara is safe. We see that in the scant few moments since we last saw her, Babs is already hard at work trying to deduce who this new Batgirl might be. Her notes, so far, read that this new Batgirl must be a Caucasian female, around 5'9" and between 125 and 130 pounds. Now, Gordon gets a sit rep from Barbara, but Barbara does not reveal anything about any Bat involvement. She says that the Black Mask simply ran away as soon as the flare went up. Now, we know better, however, and in fact, we're going to follow that thread right now. So let's go back to Batgirl, who dumps the bound bod of Roman at the feet of Batman. Now, I'm not sure if Batman is joking here or not, but he asks her if her behavior might have been a little excessive. Which, I mean, come on. Now, as Batman approaches Black Mask, the baddie insists that he remove his mask. That's kind of the no man's land gimmick for him, being maskless, no longer hiding faces and whatnot. Naturally, Batman does not take off his mask. Instead, he slings him over his shoulder and walks off. Batgirl asks where the villains wind up, but doesn't get an answer. She's about to, though, because we jump over to Blackgate Penitentiary, where Lockup and KG Beast are trying to shoo away some would-be interlopers. These are no man's landers who, well, they would rather reside inside prison than risk their lives on the streets. Now, Lockup tells him to beat it. This place is for perps, not civilians. And so, one of these civilians decides to make themselves a perp by beating the holy hell out of one of his mates. To which, Lockup fires a few shots into the poor dope's leg, which drops him to the ground. Then he invites him inside Blackgate, and then he asks if anybody else wants to join him, you know? And if so, they gotta, I guess, pay the toll. And as you might imagine, there are no takers on that offer. Now, Batman arrives to remind Lockup of his no-kill policy, and he suggests that he'd better start hoping that this dude he just shot recovers fully. He then hands Black Mask over, instructing his wardens to keep him out of Gen Pop. Lockup gives our man the big thumbs up before escorting our, I guess, level 3 boss to the D-block. Batman makes a no-look comment directed at Batgirl, because, she was following him, and he knew it. He tells her never to follow him again. Now, she was trying to be slick, of course, but there's no hiding from Batman. He takes it a step further, telling her that, it's his way or the highway, the same old thing between these two. Back to the GCPD, where Harve and Renee are eating some cold nastiness out of cans. And while they're talking about recent events, such as Foley being a dick, well, Bullock thinks he's being a dick, Montoya just says he's calling it as he sees it. They also discuss the Jim and Sarah drama, where Bullock kind of thinks she's being a dick. He says that if his wife busted his chops this much, he'd be looking for a divorce. To which Renee smirks and says, hey, it's no wonder why Harvey ain't married. We hop over to Gordon now, who is absolutely dressing down a pair of patrolmen who abandoned their posts in Old Gotham when the False Facers arrived last issue. He threatens to cut them loose, but he decides to just put them on latrine duty instead. Sarah pops in to sarcastically compliment him for how he's handling everything, which, this is going to get awkward here. This starts the fight from earlier all over again here, and it's about to get ugly. Real ugly. Just wait. But first, let's jump back to the clock tower, where Oracle is attempting to shine a makeshift bat signal into the clouds. Now, just as she's about to give up hope, the man himself appears. And we get to see one hell of a scene play out here. Now, Barbara, I mean, as we all would imagine, she's beside herself at Batman's assumed betrayal. She gives him several, like, how dare yous, which, I mean, it's understandable, you totally get that. Because Batgirl was her identity. One that cost her dearly. One that changed her life and obviously still affects her each and every single day. Now, Batman doesn't have any answers for her yet. Now, I'm not sure if he just doesn't know what to say, or if he's simply giving Babs the space to say everything she feels she needs to. Back to the Gordon-Essen bout, and we've reached the point where things are starting to get broken. like literally broken. Sarah actually mockingly hands Jim a flower pot, giving him something else he can break, driving home basically what a brat Gordon is currently being. And he slaps it out of her hands. Montoya is still nearby, and she hears all the crashing and cracking and is becoming quite nervous about what's going on in there. Sarah turns around to look for more stuff for Jim to break and gets the "don't turn your back to me" treatment, which ain't ideal. It really isn't. It feels very foreboding that we're about to enter, Hank Pym territory. Well, I mean, the only thing Hank Pym is remembered for, territory, I guess. Back to the clock tower. Here, Batman is beginning to plead his case. He tells Babs that this Batgirl was already on the scene when he returned, and how, in times like this, it's not like he could turn down the help. He needs everyone he can get his hands on here, right? She asks him who's under the mask. Batman ain't telling. Babs reminds him of who she is and how she can find out anything she needs. Batman asks her what good could possibly come of that. As in, like, what would it prove? He then asks Barbara to, like, settle her tea kettle a bit and just trust him. Let's jump back to the GCPD, where Montoya is still listening in on the fight. And, of course, there's more crashing, which is followed by moaning. And so she decides it's finally time to intervene, and so she busts in to find... Jim and Sarah tearing at each other's clothes and making out. See, I told you it was going to get ugly. Now this takes us to our outro, which is narrated by Barbara. She talks about trust and acceptance. Our scene then shifts over to a makeshift court where some no-man's-lander is on trial for a laundry list of no-goodery. Now this dude don't understand any of what's going on. He says the charges don't make any sense or even apply to him. Can we refer to this as being Kafka-esque? Probably not. Anyway, our unseen judge finds him guilty on the grounds of stupidity. And the punishment is meted out by the Tallyman, who, I swear to God, for all these years, I think I've been conflating him with Mr. Zazz. Because, the tally marks. Anyway, that's where we leave it. Next time out, I think we're headed into a series of one-parters, starting with one in Legends of the Dark Knight, number 118. Now, before we talk about this one, let's hop into the letters page, Detective Comments. Now, where they're talking about Detective number 726, which you might remember is the Batman and Joker story that closed out Aftershock that had absolutely nothing to do with Aftershock. We're starting with Joe in Jersey, who loved the back and forth between Batman and the Joker. He compares the latter to Hannibal Lecter. And he did like seeing the reference being made to the murder of Jason Todd. And I totally agree with all that. This was a very, very strong just interpersonals between Batman and the Joker for that issue. Really, really good stuff. Really put on display Chuck Dixon's strength at dialogue. I don't know that he gets... due credit for his dialogue. I know he might be viewed as like more of an action kind of a guy, but the dialogue here just killed it. It was wonderful, wonderful stuff. Joe continues. He says that the ending was too complicated to be a simple, happy one, which is true, and I think that was the point, right? Batman did save the girl from drowning, but will from this point on forever question everything. He won't make any assumptions. He'll always wonder if there's time to save someone, which is just going to put him on edge constantly. So definitely too complicated to be a pure happy ending, even though it was a happy ending in and of itself. Really, really good stuff, really deep stuff. Next, we got Tim from somewhere. Now, he plays the pedant by correcting our editorial team when they called Tech 726 Batman's 700th consecutive appearance in the title. Because you see, like a half decade before that, there was a zero issue. So technically, or rather, actually, Tech 726 was Batman's 701st issue. Do I sound this annoying when I'm being precious about stuff like this? Probably. One more letter here from Jorge in Mexico, who thanks Chuck Dixon and Brian Stelfreeze for the great story, and he thanks Editorial for publishing his letter in this issue. Presumptive, but fitting, because they did, in fact, publish his letter. Now, before we get off this page here, we have kind of a different take on the From the Den. You know, the old Denny O'Neill stuff that we've been covering? Now, this is a little ditty called Darren's Draw, or Drawer. Drawer. I can't say that word, you know, like a drawer in your bureau or your dresser, you know. I can't say that word very well. Now, this is an essay from Darren Vincenzo, wherein he's going to discuss where they found Alex Maleev and Dale Eaglesham. Now, Alex, he won a Russ Manning Award for his work on The Crow, where Dale, he's done great work on Green Arrow, as well as Punisher for Marvel. Dale also did great work for Acclaim Comics. They don't really get much mention, do they, ever, right? Do you guys remember Acclaim Comics when Valiant kind of became Acclaim? And I only knew it because of Quantum and Woody and, what was that Nicieza book, Troublemakers? It was like a weird sort of like Gen X-y type book. I remember really enjoying it back in like 97 or so, but I don't think I've given it a thought since. Now, Darren, he says that these two artists were kept in his drawer, a flat file drawer where he keeps samples from up-and-comers and talent that he eventually wants to work with. And Darren closes out by promising that we'll be dipping back into the drawer during our No Man's Land journey. Okay, so with that out of the way, how about we talk about this issue? And I'd say this two-parter, but I barely remember the first part. I know Black Mask was there. And I know he wanted to take old Gotham back, or he wanted to take old Gotham over, I guess. But we'll talk about this issue here, which was really, really good. Yeah, I've been reading a lot. Yeah, you guys know me. I read a lot of Usenet, even though, you know, it ain't really a thing anymore. And I think I've mentioned this on the air before, where people complain about the internal logic of No Man's Land in and of itself, but can't deny that they're enjoying the stories. And I mean, I'm okay. I you know, the ship kind of sailed on the internal logic for me. I'm not worried about that so much anymore. If in fact I ever was, besides just being pedantic about it. But these stories are really good. This one here, it was low key, but it was really well done. I don't even know where to start. I mean, we could start with Barbara's reaction to seeing a new Batgirl. And how Barbara, being as analytical as she is, immediately tries to solve this mystery. You know, she's what'd she call herself, a high-tech girl in a low-tech world right now? So she doesn't have all the resources she's used to. So she has to rely on, you know, old pen and paper. But she's already hard at work. She's got approximate heights and weights and assumed, that she's a Caucasian. I don't know if she's just a master of body language or what, but her perception here is pretty cool to see, because suddenly nothing else in No Man's Land matters besides figuring out who this person is who stole her life, who took over her mantle without her blessing. And I think that's really, really cool to see. As was her back and forth with Batman later on in the issue, where it's a very uncomfortable conversation. But Batman handled it in a really, really good way, where I think he realized nothing he could say would help. So he just let Barbara go. He let her just get everything she needed off her chest, you know? Basically just let her talk until she ran out of words. And then said what he had to say, which was, I didn't pick this person. This person was already here. And, you know, when there's a big fire, you're not going to turn a hose away, right? I mean, you're going to use every tool that you can. And if this Batgirl, whoever she may be, is going to be there and is going to help, and is going to just try to maintain order, then he'd be foolish to send her away, or turn her away, or deny her the opportunity to do some good. And Barbara understood that. And because, I mean, it does make perfect sense here. Everybody is doing what they can. And we know Barbara here is doing everything she can with her little, you know, army of no man's landers, right? They're doing basically all the legwork in Gotham here. They're appearing place at hotspots, you know, they're checking out the secret stashes of materials and supply. They are basically her flesh and blood internet at this point. You know, they are her network. And I think Batman having a network of his own is something that would resonate with Barbara. And it's not something she could argue, regardless of how she feels about it personally. Because, I mean, you'd have to imagine this would be heartbreaking to see someone wearing your... I mean, Barbara's situation is complicated as it is here. She can no longer be Batgirl. It's not like she chose not to be, although, you know, their retirement was kind of there. But at any point in time, she could have gotten back in the cowl. But of course, that choice was taken from her. And now she sees someone else, a pretender, bearing her mark. And I'm really looking forward to the first time their paths actually cross. I don't remember when that is. I don't remember how it goes, but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it play out. The other big takeaway, we're keeping it in the family here. This is more Gordon drama. Jim and Sarah, that was uncomfortable to read because it felt so real. We've all seen people argue, whether it's in real life or film or even in our homes. And it was very, very uncomfortable where, like, Gordon's smashing stuff and Sarah is treating him like he's a buffoon. She's like, here, break this. Just egging him on to the point where he literally balls his fist. And when she turns around, he snaps at her. Don't turn your back on me. I mean, they could have gone so many different ways with that. And thankfully I don't know if I want to say thankfully, since the scene we did get that ensued was disgusting, but it could have been something that couldn't have been walked back. You know, I joked about the Pym thing. The Pym thing, I hate that that's the only thing that Hank Pym is known for. I actually wrote a pretty long piece at Chris's on Infinite Earths about the slap, because I was inspired to write it because I went to a comic shop and people were talking about the an Avengers movie, or maybe it was the Ant-Man. It must have been the Ant-Man movie. I guess that's where Hank Pym would be. And I don't even know if Hank Pym's in those movies. Regardless. One of the goofballs in the comic store was like, man, they should tell the story of that one Ant-Man who always gets drunk and beats his wife. And I tell you, it was like all I could do not to be the actually guy there, you know. So I went through with like a forensic comb the entire deal. It's just, I hate when we distill a character down to something like that. I usually give like the Speedy's a junkie sort of a gimmick for that, because it's every issue that Speedy's in, somebody's got to remind us that, oh, this guy used heroin. I feel like that's similar with Pym. Anytime a new writer comes on a Pym book, they got to make sure they remind us that this one time 30-odd years ago, maybe an artist drew the panel wrong. The article at Chris's on Infinite Earths, if I remember to link it, I will, but there's a lot of behind-the-scenes crap in there, but where in the hell was I again? Oh yeah, Commissioner Gordon. I tell you, tangents everywhere. And boy, if I saved any of the attempts I made at making this episode over the past couple of weeks, the tangents were even deeper and darker and worse than that. But back on topic, Gordon and Sarah here. Really, really well done scene. A really scary scene for a minute there. And then ultimately, a pretty disgusting scene. I think I mentioned last time the artist here, I don't remember his name, Frank Terran. He's a very, very talented artist, but he draws very ugly people. His Gordon, especially, looked like Nosferatu. I mean, like literal pointy teeth and everything. It was just very unpleasant to look at. So to see that pawing at another human was kind of nasty. But I think that's probably all I got to say about this issue. It was a good one. It was definitely a good one. I'm really digging how all the stuff is coming together here. We got Batman going to Blackgate. We got Batgirl being suspicious. We got the potential meeting of Batgirl past and present. It's they're laying some really, really great groundwork here, and I can't wait to keep on. But with all that said, how about we hop into the mailbag here for some mail that's been waiting in the inbox for quite a long time now. We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu, who's talking about Batman 565, which was the first part of Mosaic. And Chris says, Barbara dreams of her days as Batgirl. At least subconsciously, she misses being able to swing from tall buildings, fight the bad guys, and be a costumed hero. To see someone else in a Batgirl suit doing the things she can no longer do must be shocking and crushing for her. Even though she'd already chosen to give up being Batgirl before she was crippled by the Joker, someone else usurping her identity without permission should be aggravating. That's true, that's true. There was the Batgirl special that came out just shortly before the Killing Joke, where Batgirl like had her final case and decided to hang things up. Somewhat ominously, I want to say the last page of the Batgirl special is an ad for the Killing Joke, which is pretty weird. Growing up, I was a Marvel guy, you know? So DC time for me is very nebulous, even now. Even now, where like I probably have just as much DC as Marvel in my library. But DC time is just so weird. because I think of these things happening like in a vacuum almost. Like, okay, well, there was the last Batgirl story, and then maybe 5 years later they did the Killing Joke. But no, it was like right away. Right away it happened. And I was actually going through some stuff for just my own reading projects that'll never ever get done. But I went to a comic convention last weekend. There was a local con here. It was called Old Man Con, which I don't love the name, but I do love the vibe there, because it was just comics. It was just comic books were there. No Funko Pops, no movie crap, just comics and people who wanted to buy and discuss comic books. It reminded me of being a kid at the old mall cons, you know, like I was that 10 or 11 year old kid trudging through the Sunbet Mall trying to find a copy of X-Factor number 1, which I did, and then I found one again the other day for the same price. It was $5, which made me more emotional than I thought it would. That might give you a hint as to my current state of mind here, but that was unexpected and neat to see. But anyway, I filled in the remaining issues of my Batman 400s, which were a couple issues of Death in the Family and one part of 10 Nights of the Beast. That's all I needed to finish the 400, so I did that. And I started going through everything, and I became aware of how quickly everything moved post-crisis, where, you know, there's Batman Year One, of course. Then, of course, there's Batman Year Two in Detective Comics. That's that one that is somehow, like, crazy, crazy overpriced now because Todd McFarlane's art is in it. But I remember reading both and assuming that they took place years apart, when in fact, the month after Year One ended, Year Two started in Detective. I had no idea. I tell you, like, DC time is just, it's just so weird to me. It's hard for me to kind of compartmentalize where these things happen. I mean, there's another tangent, but yeah, Barbara, where was I? Yeah, Barbara giving up the mantle in the Batgirl special, and then just a month or two later, the Joker happened to her. Back to Chris. He says, correct me if I missed it, but has anyone in story called the new female Batgirl yet? I think so. I think Batman did, actually. I think she referred to herself as Batgirl as well, but I could be wrong. I already filed the issues we covered, so yeah, don't quote me on that, but I think Batman called her Batgirl. Back to Chris. He says, the revelation of Batman's prison is interesting. Bruce must have been squirreling away massive amounts of supplies if he intends to imprison the baddest of the bad for any amount of time. It's a massive undertaking to run a prison of any size. At least he put Lockup in charge of the prisoners. I was worried he was going to have Alfred acting as warden, guard, and prison chef. Had this story happened in the Silver Age, I'm sure that's what would have happened. We'd have Alfred literally wearing a bunch of different hats, I'm sure. But no, it was definitely cool to see, because I'd never heard of this Lockup before. I'm sure I've seen him, but I never thought about him. So I like that we found the guy with the incarceration fetish to run the prison. And KG Beast there is an extra, you know, heavy. All the better, right? And I want to thank you so much for writing in and apologize for how long it took for me to respond. Next up, CJ. And he's talking about something I was talking about during one of our recent episodes here, where I was talking a little bit about like bucket list reads, you know, those to-dos, those, I think all of our to-read piles are probably mountainous at this point, right? There's just so much stuff to read, and it's so easy to get, so it's hard to get to the things that you plan to get to. And I'd mentioned things like Cerebus and Love and Rockets. I eventually want to do like a new universe read through. There's a lot of stuff I want to get to. But CJ's replying here. He says, those Cerebus phone books are cool collection formats in terms of price points. Very, very true. I've only read the first one, and I really wasn't hooked. It was okay, but nothing special. I know that's when it was mainly a Conan satire spoof, and it later gets deeper, but I also know some of that deep approach leads to Sim's questionable attitudes, so I've had no desire to read past what I've done. Although the art from Sim and his assistant Gerhard is impressive, and it gets more impressive from what I've seen. And I tell you what, that's kind of the reason I want to read through Cerebus, because I know it gets weird. I recently, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I recently was at a shop where they had most of the Cerebus library for $5 each. And I think there were like three of the phone books there that I needed, so I grabbed them up. And they get really weird the deeper you go. And I thought that would be a really cool thing to experience. I think it would have been better to experience it in singles format, because then you have the letters pages, and I know that gets out there. I know that gets really weird. I know there are essays that Dave Sim writes that are very, what did CJ called it, questionable. Totally, totally weird, weird stuff. A lot of wrong-headed stuff, but also just a lot of just interesting stuff. I like that weirdness. I like that. It kind of adds a layer to the experience, and I don't know if it actually adds anything to the story, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me to find out that it did. So I know, like, I don't know if he got very religious or he just got into religious iconography. Like, there was a lot of, like, Yahweh stuff. My knowledge of Sim's later work mostly comes from articles that Paul O'Brien wrote back on The Ninth Art, was it? He had a website that it was a collaborative effort. It was a lot of essays about comics. The sort of stuff you'd see like in the Comics Journal. Not light reading. Not like a breezy wizard type fare. Or even like blog fare. This is more analytic and journalistic sort of writing. Way better than anything I could do. So I enjoyed reading it. And he would occasionally do a Dave Sim post. And I think he called them all like Sim City. You know, it was like Sim City, now entering Sim City, and be like now leaving Sim City. And he would kind of dig into all the weirdness in these issues of Cerebus. And O'Brien would also cover Cerebus is in capsule form as part of his X-Axis review posts every week on Usenet. So I knew he was following it, and it was just really cool to be able to get a little bit of commentary on the Sim stuff, because all I knew was that it was weird. And to get a little bit of a deeper look into it, yes, it's very, very weird, but also very interesting. I, too, have only read the first... I don't think I made it through the entire first phone book. But yeah, it was definitely very, you know, inspired by Conan the Barbarian. Very satirical look at that sort of, you know, sword and sorcery sort of gimmick. Which, not my bread and butter, for sure. I've never been able to get into Conan. I think the only issues with Conan in it that I've enjoyed were in Savage Avengers. During, I think Deadpool showed up. And it was, might have been King in Black. The King in Black tie-ins or something like that. But anything else, I really can't get into it. It's not my cup of tea. But CJ is 100% right that the art is amazing. I think Gerhard came in to do backgrounds. And holy smokes. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful work. The early Cerebus, a little bit more cartoony, a little bit more kind of Sunday comics look to Cerebus himself. But as Sim's style matured, just amazing. Amazing stuff. Like, would put, like, Disney to shame. Just beautiful, beautiful work. CJ continues. The Bone 1 volume is a cool collection, too. I had it, and I lent it to enough people that it got to the point where it wasn't even readable because of use. And yes, reading it when it was in pristine condition was still difficult because of its size. I broke down and bought the individual color Scholastic versions on the cheap to replace the 1-volume collection. But I kind of regret it because the black and white artwork in that collection, and Smith's original collections, is better than the color artwork, in my opinion. I think the coloring is well done, and it amplifies the comedic elements, but it also sacrifices some of the drama, suspense, and the weight that the black and white artwork adds. And I tell you, I don't think I've ever seen, outside of like covers, I don't think I've ever seen Bone in color. Now, I'm honestly not sure what I would prefer. I know the black and white artwork is very, very striking. It's very, very good. And that reminds me of the relatively recent phone books that Dark Horse put out for ElfQuest. These are books that must weigh like 5 pounds. They're so thick, but they're all in black and white. And the original Warp Graphics magazine format, those were black and white as well. And Wendy Pini's art is just another level. So it didn't really need the color. The color was great in some of the collections that I've seen, of course, but seeing it again in black and white, just gorgeous. Really, really nice. To the point where I think I actually prefer the black and white. So I guess it doesn't really surprise me that the black and white Bone might be more appealing than the color. You'd figure, you know, color would be better. But sometimes work is meant to be seen in black and white. And Bone might be there. And I can tell you ElfQuest is certainly there for me. And I want to thank CJ for sharing his thoughts on that and inspiring conversation, because I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on black and white versus color. If a comic is originally in black and white, I mean, we were just talking about Cerebus, which, you know, besides covers, is purely black and white. I mean, there was even a joke about that on that in that Spawn issue, that very, very pretentious Spawn issue, where that was just... yeah, that was something. But on the cover of it, like, Cerebus is in color, and he freaks out. He's like, ah, color. I think that's, you know, it's pretty funny. But I wonder what Cerebus would look like in color. That'd be weird. I think that'd be pretty weird. But of course, my opinion don't matter. I want to hear your opinion. So what say you? Color, black and white. What do you prefer? Does it depend? And also, I'd love to hear your guys' bucket list reads here. I keep adding to the damn bucket list every time I look at my bookshelf or anytime I'm online or something. There's always one more thing that it's like, ah, I gotta make sure I read that before, you know, before I leave this planet. But I look forward to hearing what you all think, which is a decent enough segue to giving you the contact information for this program. If you'd like to join in the conversation, I invite you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, and also on all the socials and whatnot. But I think that'll do it for me for today. Hopefully, it ain't too long before you hear from me again. But as always, I would like to thank you so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, hopefully, I'll be talking to you again real, real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks. Start